This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hello there and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. It is a Thursday, 22nd of September. Here's what's coming up on the pod this morning. Big focus, of course, on the Federal Reserve. We're going to jump straight into that in a few moments' time. But it's not the only game in town. Also speaking to the woman who runs Heriot Watt University here in Dubai. She is Professor Heather McGregor, and they've done something really nice. They've made their MBAs available for free for refugees in Lebanon. It's been going on for a while now, and she joins us in the studio to give us an update. That's coming up later on. Then we're going to be talking real estate with John Lyons of Espace. He says the Dubai market is booming despite the fact that the dirham is so strong and despite the fact that interest rates are rising. And then finally, this is interesting, talking about the internet that we have here in the UAE. The good news is it's some of the fastest and most reliable in the world. The bad news, it's expensive. Brandy has been speaking to the guys at Surfshark who did the research. All that's come on the Business Breakfast, but let's dive straight into that big story this morning, that Fed decision to raise rates overnight.
Right, Central Bank Week. And despite the Bank of Japan this morning continuing to commit to its loose monetary policy, keeping overnight rates on hold, the hawks still have it at the moment.
Well, they certainly do in the United States, don't they? So overnight, we had a 75 basis point rate increase from the Federal Reserve. That wasn't a surprise. That's what most people were banking on. And in fact, it's less than some less than some people expected. But it was the language from Jay Powell at his press conference afterwards. Let's hear from him now. This is what he had to say.
My colleagues and I are acutely aware that high inflation imposes significant hardship as it erodes purchasing power, especially for those least able to meet the higher costs of essentials, like food, housing, and transportation. We are taking forceful and rapid steps to moderate demand so that it comes into better alignment with supply. Reducing inflation is likely to require a sustained period of below-trend growth, and there will very likely be some softening of labor market conditions.
Okay, do you know what? I like Mr. Powell, Steady Feddy, as he is called by some sections of the media. The language, though, is so euphemistic as to be, I mean, when he's talking about a softening of labour market conditions there, he means people are going to lose jobs.
Millions of them.
Exactly. When he talks about some pain, he means we're headed for a recession. When he talks about eroding purchasing power, he means inflation and everything's going to get more expensive. I mean, there are euphemisms, and there is the bedtime story that we got given by Jay Powell last night.
Do you think he couched his term? Do you think he wasn't straight talking enough?
No, because I think I don't quite know the strategy of it. If it's not to spook, well, I mean, forget spooking markets. Markets, as you said, had factored in the 75 basis points. What they hadn't factored in was some of the commentary around the two hikes to come, the first, which looks like it'll be another 75 points, and that had markets yo-yoing a little bit yesterday. Fine, whatever. But in terms of not spooking regular people, people are not stupid. They know what they're paying at the grocery store. They know what's happening to their mortgages or their rents. So talking about some pain, and talking about softening labour market conditions. If your company's making layoffs, you know what that feels like. You don't, I don't know, I just feel like I would have preferred it to be a little bit more straight talking.
But we've always had Fed speak, haven't we? I guess. And, you know, we played Elizabeth Warren yesterday on the Business Breakfast, who's a critic of his, saying, Mr. Chairman, you are going to drive the economy off a cliff. He's never going to come out with that kind of metaphorical language, is he? A Fed chairman, and you kind of don't. There's a bit of me that thinks I kind of want my central bankers to be
tiptoeing around
a little bit, yeah, jargonistic, and I don't know, maybe not.
I don't know. I'm not. I don't love the language about it. But I'm less against the rate rises that that you are. We are going to look, by the way, at what they mean for the property market in a little bit on the show. That is going to be interesting. But we've been already getting the Economist take this morning.
Dan Richards, Senior Economist, Emirates NBD. Stock market's down 2% overnight. We knew we were going to get 75 basis points. So, in your view, Daniel, what was it that spooked the markets?
It was particularly hawkish language, I think. Like you say, the 75 basis point was widely expected. And if some people had been talking about 100 basis points, so it wasn't as bad in that regard as perhaps it might have been. But I think it was a language she was using, such as pain, higher for longer. They made a significant rise to their projections for how high rates would go compared to the June outlook. They now see the median projection for 4.6% next year. But also, you know, the growth forecast, 0.2% this year, he didn't explicitly say recession, but that's not far off. And given the rise we expect in unemployment, for that kind of an unemployment level to rise without seeing a recession would take some pretty magic doing by the Fed, I guess.
Very quickly, what does it mean for us here in the UAE?
The dollar strength we've seen will persist, so that will potentially be a drag on exports. Well, obviously, it's pretty good for anyone sending money home or traveling. It's not necessarily great for the economy at large. And also, it means borrowing rates will go up here as well, so people's spending on their mortgage will rise as well.
Daniel Richards, Emirates NBD.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
In the week of the UN General Assembly, a group of Syrian and Palestinian refugees in Lebanon are starting to sit down and study for MBAs. It's part of a program that is being spearheaded by a university about 400 metres away from our studio here in the Business Breakfast, and a woman who's just taken a top job at that university here in Dubai. Professor Heather McGregor is the new provost and the vice principal of Harriet Watt University, Dubai, and she's in our studio this morning. Good morning, Heather. It's lovely to see you again.
Brandy, it's lovely to be here again, especially after the last few years where we haven't been able to visit at all.
Indeed. Welcome to Dubai. Congratulations on the job. And tell me what you're doing with these, not just refugees, but also vulnerable Lebanese students.
Yes, we have opened it from refugees to vulnerable Lebanese students, mainly because we're working in partnership with a charity called Their World, who it's actually a charity that was originally set up by Sarah Brown, the wife of Gordon Brown, our former Prime Minister. And she and I together went out to raise the money to do this. And we were able to raise the money to put an MBA into a refugee camp in the Lebanon. And we thought, well, going to all that trouble, it would be good to open it to vulnerable people in the Lebanon as well.
So this is Edinburgh Business School, part of Harriet Watt. How exactly does it work?
So our MBA is a leading distance learning MBA. It's actually been around for 30 years, so it's nothing. There's nothing new about this, and also it doesn't require synchronous learning. I mean, if you want to, you can come to lectures on campus, but if you, for any reason, are not able to, you can study for it completely asynchronously. So what we're able to do is download everything onto a tablet or a laptop or whatever. Interestingly, the first cohort a couple of years ago, we gave tablets to. We've learnt that laptops will be better. And so this time we've given them all laptops, and they can then study in their own time at their own pace. They obviously still have to take the exams, you know, at the same time as everybody else and the same exams as everybody else, but they can do it all themselves. The issue in refugee camps is usually that either electricity is not reliable and therefore the internet is also not reliable. So having an asynchronous opportunity to study is very important.
So you study when you can?
You study when you can. And if that's 2 o'clock in the morning, it's 2 o'clock in the morning.
What other challenges are these students facing that you're helping them to overcome?
Well, you know, less than 3% of all refugees anyway have access to higher education. Frankly, and rightly, the UN and the world's agencies are focused on trying to get a primary and secondary education into these camps. So higher education is not something that's been a priority. So what we are aiming to do is give them access to higher education. Many of the people on our course actually are, for instance, Syrian refugees who had their education interrupted when they had to leave the country, and so they're coming back to it later. And giving them that access. The other thing is that these days, you know, refugee camps are enormous and there are businesses all over them. So we're hoping to be able to enable them to run their businesses better than they do at the moment.
And this is your second cohort of students in this scheme. How well have you seen the first cohort do? What's performance been like under these conditions?
Well, I've been really impressed with how the first cohort have done. First of all, can I tell you, everybody said this was doomed to failure. You know, people said to me that if I hand out tablets to refugees, they'll all run away with the tablets. And, you know, I mean, honestly, that people were not optimistic about this. And that hasn't happened at all. Of the original 20 that started, I mean, we expected that people would fall by the wayside, but 18 are still going, and you know, five of them have accelerated, so they've actually been studying two units at the same time and will finish 3 months early. So I'm one of them with distinction, so I'm really, really impressed. And you know what, these are people who've got, as I said, unreliable electricity. Even if you've got a tablet, you've got to charge it, so they're having to, you know, live hand to mouth. They've got trying to run hustle businesses on the side. You know, I mean, it's amazing how disadvantaged they are, and they're still finding time to study.
And you've moved from Scotland, where you were the executive dean of Edinburgh Business School. The MBA is coming from Edinburgh Business School, and you're now going to be running the university here in Dubai. What will that mean for this program? How big do you want to grow it?
Well, anything that limits us is funding, to be honest. And I don't want to jinx it by announcing it live on air, but I hope we found a sponsor to help us continue with a third cohort. But what I'd really like to do is move out of the Lebanon. So there are many other places with big refugee challenges, and I would love to find people who would help us to move to other parts of the world. You know, there are 200 million people who don't go to school, let alone university, in the world. And sadly, I think refugees will be with us for our lifetime in one part of the world or another. And so I would love to be able to continue to offer this in other parts of the world.
Well, you're in the studio in the morning when we are talking about recession on the back of Jay Powell's comments, the Fed comments with the interest rate rise there, the World Bank warning that we could see a global recession next year. Traditionally, downturns mean a pickup in MBA study. We've got about a minute and a half with you. Is that still the case?
Yes, I think it is. Interestingly, MBAs globally have been declining in developed countries. And it's really the emerging economies that are pursuing MBA qualifications. It's not just an MBA that will see a pickup, I think, in times of a recession. It will be all postgraduate programs. I think people use times of recession to upskill. And whether that's an MBA, whether it's a master's in something else, whether it's even a doctorate degree, you know, I think people will use this time to upskill. I mean, interestingly, for instance, in the over the whole COVID episode, I had a lot of free time that I would normally spend travelling or commuting, and I used it to qualify as an accountant. So even I, at my age, am upskilling. So I think it's an opportunity for people to upskill. And what is important is to be able to finance that. And I was very interested this week that the UN announced the International Finance Facility for Education, which has released $20 billion for education. So that's a major landmark for us this week.
Good news, Professor Heather McGregor, the new Provost and Vice Principal of Harriet Watt University here in Dubai. Thank you for your time.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Answering your property questions this morning, welcoming to the studio the Managing Director of S-Pass Real Estate, John Lyons. Morning, John.
Morning, Richard. How are you?
I'm good, thanks very much indeed. Lots of questions coming in about that interest rate hike overnight. I'll get to that in a second. First of all, let's just remind ourselves what Jay Powell had to say, and specifically, in the middle of this soundbite, you'll hear him refer to the property market.
Growth in consumer spending has slowed from last year's rapid pace, in part reflecting lower real disposable income and tighter financial conditions. Activity in the housing sector has weakened significantly, in large part reflecting higher mortgage rates. Higher interest rates and slower output growth also appear to be weighing on business fixed investment.
So Yasser writes in, I'd like to know what impact would the housing market have with this hike in interest rate? I know your colleague Essan is going to do a deep dive on this in about 10 minutes time with Tom, but briefly your thoughts, John?
I think it was as expected, and it's good news that they've come out with the hike of 0.75%, and particularly that they've been a little bit more robust in their language afterwards. Because that sends a clear message that they're going to get this under control sooner rather than later, which is what we need in the long term. As for the comments about the real estate market, I also think it's good news that the US market has slowed, whereas we haven't seen that really in Dubai yet. So our ability to absorb these interest rate hikes is greater than the US, I believe.
We got the thoughts of Essam Jamshidzadeh, head of mortgages at your organisation, in about 10 minutes' time. Well, let's look at the strength of the real estate market at the moment, because you've been looking at the first few weeks of September. The summer lull, of course, but then September is the real barometer of what's happening. Back to school, back to buying property. What's the data telling you?
Yeah, so those that were listening in the middle of the summer would have heard me talk about the slowdown in the summer being more significant than the previous year. And the big question at the time was, is this just a travel-related story, or has this got something to do with interest rates rising? We were all very keen to see what happens when the schools go back in September. We're now 3 weeks into September, and I'm delighted to say that the market has really kicked back in. Our buyer registrations, for example, last 4 weeks compared to the previous 4 weeks, up 70%. So it's a significant difference.
What do we know about these buyers, who they are, where they're from? How much visibility do you have on that?
The trend is the same as it has been all year. Buyers coming from all over the place. A lot of people that live in the country already and have done. They've been renting. Rents have gone up significantly. And even with higher mortgage rates, the cost benefit of owning a property versus renting is significant. Also, I think that the main reason why people haven't bought properties is because they haven't got the deposit. So as the economy's been good, people have been saving that deposit. When they're in the position to buy, quite often they're buying.
Yeah, the economy's booming, you get a bonus, and then you can use it as a down payment and you're on your way.
Exactly. And we saw at the end of Q1 GDP growth year on year, 5.9%. So we're in a very strong position here in Dubai for people to be in jobs, saving money. And the good news is that property prices are not rising at the same rate as they were this time last year. So it's becoming easier for people to get on the housing ladder.
Let's talk about the impact that currencies are having on foreign buyers. I mean, we're at record highs, 20, 30, 40-year highs against many major currencies, 20-year high against the euro, 37-year high against sterling. These are big source markets. The Indian rupee, we're almost at 22 rupees for one dirham. Big source markets for buying property here. Are you seeing any impact of that? Are you having any conversations with them about the currency?
I'm surprised, to be honest, that it's not having the impact that I would have expected. In 2014, 15, 16, when we saw the currency move significantly against the euro, the pound, we did see that that contributed to a slowdown in the real estate market. It just hasn't happened at the moment. And when we look at our number of deals being signed in the sales department, this is a forward-looking indicator. Even though this is still a short period of time, but it does show how things are kicking in. The last 3 weeks compared to the three-week period, that up 40%. And compared to the same period last year, the same three-week period, we're up 17% in the number of contracts that we're signing. So there's still plenty of appetite. And as I said, I think a lot of the buyers are actually already living in Dubai, so the currency isn't so relevant for them.
Can we talk about the education market? Because it's something I know you guys follow closely, the number of students in private schools. Tell me what the data is and then tell me what you read into it.
Yes, so I like to look at the KHDA student enrollment figures. I also look at the population clock, and I like to kind of match the two against each other. Population in Dubai is up about 82,000 people compared to this time last year. And then when you look at the school figures, there's more than 300,000 people, students in private schools. That's the first time it's ever breached the 300,000 level. It's like 4.5%, 4.9%, I think, greater than the same period less than 12 months earlier. So you've got people moving to Dubai, and you can see it in the school figures. There's lots of students enrolling in the schools.
And they've got to live somewhere.
They've all got to live somewhere. And, you know, when we look at the number of properties being handed over on a yearly basis, in the last few years, it's roughly been about 30,000 units being handed over into the market. But what's very interesting is that I expect that figure to fall in the years ahead. The reason being that in the years 2019, 20 and 21, there was significantly less properties launched onto the market on the off-plan market compared to the three-year period before that by 58%. So it takes time, obviously, from when a property is launched into the market as an off-plan project for when it actually gets built and handed over into the market. I feel like we're going to have a an undersupply of properties being handed over to the market in the years ahead.
But that's a 2 or 3 years. That's a 2024-25 problem, you think? Or
I think it's a 2022, 2023, 2024 problem. I think we're already experiencing that problem. A lot of the people that we're talking about who are moving to Dubai are looking to see what options they have, and there is not so much supply. The properties that are being handed over don't necessarily match up with the types of people that are moving here. And I think that trend will continue because of the under supply of new projects coming to the market in 19, 20 and 21. As I said, 58% less properties being launched onto the off-plan market compared to the three-year period earlier, 16, 17 and 18. So it will be interesting to see what happens, but certainly lots of people moving to Dubai and not very many properties expected to be handed over. That's going to be the biggest driver of this market, in my opinion.
But we are going to hear, if you're a developer driving to work this morning, listening to John from Espace saying there's going to be a shortage of supply, your ears are going to prick up and you're going to think, right then, I will build. And I'll figure out what people want, whether it's apartments or townhouses or luxury villas, whatever it may be. Because the one thing we don't have here in Dubai is a shortage of land. If we were in Mumbai or Hong Kong and that conversation was being had, it's like, well, tough. Because there's no more land, so you can't go out and build to meet supply. Here, though, we do. There are land plots available, not just in Dubai, but other Emirates as well. A quick thought on that.
So I think that's what we need. We need more properties to be built and to be launched onto the off-plan market, not necessarily to the extent that we saw in 2014, where there was a real boom, significant, maybe 4 or 5 times as many properties launched into the market in 2014 compared to, let's say, 2019, 2020. The other thing is that at that time, 2014, 15, 16, 17 and 18, that 5-year period, there was a lot of properties launched onto the market at a time when the economy was not that strong, when the strong dollar was having an impact on people's ability to buy, and when the oil price obviously was doing something that we didn't want it to be doing. Now we're in a different situation. So I think we do need more supply, and that supply needs to be absorbed by the increasing population, which it will be.
John, always good to talk to you. Appreciate your time this morning. That's the voice of John Lyons, Managing Director of Espace Real Estate. John, thanks.
Thank you.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast.
Where we are talking internet this morning after a survey from a company that previously we'd never heard of, Surfshark.
Baby shark, do-do-do-do-do, baby shark, do-do-do-do-do, baby shark. Mommy shark.
Any excuse. So the Surfshark Digital Quality of Life Index is out. Surfshark is a company involved in privacy and internet security. And they are, for the fourth time, measuring how the world is doing when it comes to supplying us with the internet. The UAE has done very well when it comes to the speed of mobile internet, leading the pack, actually number one, number three when it comes to quality of internet overall, but falling very much to the middle of the pack, 75, I think. This is all out of 117 countries when it comes to affordability. So we wanted to put all of that in context and find out what exactly is being measured and how we should be reading it. Pavlas Yunus is a researcher from Surfshark. I've been chatting to him about this, and I began by asking him exactly what it is they're measuring.
We have 5 distinctive pillars. First, we're measuring affordability, where basically we're taking into account how much people need to work to afford the broadband and mobile internet. Then we're also checking the quality of the internet, which includes stability and speed. And then we go through e-infrastructure, electronic security, and electronic government.
All right, all those things together making up the quality of life ranking, the overall ranking, where the UAE came in 44th. So in the top third there. I broke down all the different elements that made up the quality of life ranking with Pavlas, starting with speed.
Yes, so UAE is actually has a very good speed of internet, especially mobile-less internet. It ranks number one on mobile speed globally, and it, due to this fact, it's ranked number three globally as for the internet quality. So congratulations on that. This is actually a very, very nice achievement. And we can see that also UAE improved some factors since the last year. So it's also very nice to see.
And for those interested in the detail, I also asked what we're actually measuring when it comes to speed. Are we talking about 5G?
We in general looking what it's an average speed of mobile speed and broadband speed. So those factors are a bit different. And well, in the case of UAE, it might be 5G, but you know, in the countries which hasn't achieved so much in internet speed, they don't even go to the 5G. So in general, we're checking what are the speeds of download and upload across the world.
And quality, whether UAE was number three?
Stability. Like, basically, a quality consists of two main factors. It's mobile speed and stability. So basically, you know, sometimes you could achieve very high speed, but for a fraction of the second. But you want to have a speed which is consistent. So, for example, you could stream the video, or you could have a proper chat or video call. So we measure these two factors. We check how in the mobile speed and broadband speed improved over the year. So basically, if a country was in a bad position last year, maybe it achieved much, much better results this year. So this is the last factor which goes into the quality of speed.
When it comes to affordability, the UAE came in 75th out of 117. I asked Pallavis why we were where we were.
Well, basically, again, we check the affordability of cheapest mobile internet and cheapest broadband internet package. So we check how much people would need to work to afford for the internet. Yes, as you say, the UAE came around the middle of the ranking, but globally we see that internet is less affordable this year than the last year. It might be due to economic situation, but basically people need to work a bit more than the last year to afford a good internet, and that's a worrisome trend across the world.
That surprised me, given I don't know the amount of work from homeness and the rest of it. I asked Pallavis what his gut sense was when it came to why the internet had become more expensive globally during COVID.
It might be due to the economical situation. We see the global inflation across the world. We see that many commodities are more expensive. My guess would be that this is not strictly related due to the internet. So this is related to the global economic situation. Of course, this is a worsened trend because internet basically gives many opportunities, including economic opportunities. So many businesses they need to have a good internet to operate across the world and be successful. So this is an issue which we should address in the future, so people could connect to the internet affordably and they wouldn't need to work a lot.
Yeah, Pavlos Sunas of Surfshark. Surfshark, even. He's one of the researchers on the Digital Quality of Life Index. And his comments there about the rising cost of everything are interesting, because he's saying there that globally in their survey, they found that the cost of internet went up last year around the world. And he points out there sort of the danger of that from an inequality point of view. And it just made me think of the book. It was huge when it came out well over a decade ago, The World is Flat, Thomas Friedman. And one of the premises of the book was that one of the reasons that the world was supposedly getting flat and easier for everyone to compete was the fact that where you were was becoming less important, geography, because of the internet. And you could argue that's been one of the basic tenets of work from home as well. But if you have work from everywhere, more for the people who can afford for work from everywhere than those that don't, not so flat after all. And we've been talking inequality in line, Richard's favourite subject, in line of the Fed numbers. And some numbers that have come out this week when it comes to, and it does relate to inequality in COVID. 5 millionaires were made in the last year. 5 million, rather, more millionaires were made in the last year. And in the US, it was the biggest rise in millionaires than they have seen in, gosh, where are the numbers? How many years was it? This is a Credit Suisse report. They've got their annual global growth report. For any country in any year this century, it was the largest increase in millionaires in the US. At the same time, the World Bank has come out and said that 100 million people were pushed into extreme poverty in the pandemic. And it is one of those things about the rate rises, isn't it? That when we're talking about who's going to feel that pain that Jay Powell is talking about, is that evenly distributed pain?
Well, I would argue, because the poorest people in the world don't have access to financial services, which is a problem in its own right, but potentially that means they are insulated from interest rate rises, because if you haven't got a bank account, you haven't got a loan. I mean, maybe dealing with a loan shark, but loan sharks aren't basing their repayments on 75 basis points from the Federal Reserve.
It's an interesting point. I'm not sure how it flies.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.